In the afternoon and the evening of Tuesday, February 4th, we are going to be sponsoring here at St. Stephen's a couple of seminars that are called Where There's a Will, There's a Way. And these are seminars that are designed to help members of the congregation learn a bit more about wills and, yes, about giving to the church. And we're doing this because we've had a number of people tell us that they would like to remember the church in their wills. And I want to say this is quite wonderful. Some of those people have spoken to me about it, and I will respect your wishes concerning anonymity, but I would like to say a public thanks for choosing to participate in this work we do together in this rather important way. That you are remembering and encouraging and finding a way to support the congregation who will be here in future years is deeply appreciated. And if any of you are interested in attending the seminars, I'd like to encourage you. As I've got a little handout here that it's concerns how a legal will works in British Columbia and how you choose an executor and what a power of attorney means and taxes and fees and then there's the whole question of bequests and charitable giving that are included in that. One of the things I found intriguing is that something close to 50% of members of congregations, when they are asked, will say that they would indeed like to remember the church in their wills, but they've never been asked. And so they hadn't really gone any more than thinking about it, or any further than thinking about it. And so now you've been asked. You have been spoken to about the subject. So we're holding these seminars to give you some information about the legacy program that we've put together here at St. Stephen's. And just to be clear, we are not trying to complicate your lives. We are not trying to interfere with your family's expectations about bequests or the like. We do not want to go there. We are not attempting to lure you into signing anything on the dotted line. We're far from it. What we are trying to do is offer information for people who have questions about wills in general, and particularly for those of you who want to remember the church in some way. We'd like to help you with that. And there are lots of ways to do that, more than I had realized. So if you'd like a little bit more information, I and others would be happy to chat with you after the service. But in thinking about these workshops, it got me thinking about money, and it got me thinking about why and how we give. Now, shortly before I left theological school, one of my professors, whose job it was to prepare us for the rigors of actually doing ministry in a real-life church, I remember this. It was a morning. It was a morning seminar, and he looked at us, and his words have been written indelibly in my mind. He said to us, "Mission is everything. Mission is everything." And in the church, it's really easy to lose sight of that because there's lots and lots and lots of other really good and seemingly critical things that inevitably catch our attention. And when they do, sometimes we forget what our goal really is. Now, I'm someone who, for better or for worse, spends a lot of my waking moments and a good portion of my sleeping moments, which should worry me, thinking about the church. And I not infrequently find myself losing that particular thread, because it's just that easy to do. Once again, it's a matter of getting the order right. See, what happens is we get waylaid discussing what are secondary issues, and we misplace the primary issue, which for the church is always mission. Mission being what we're trying to accomplish, trying to fulfill the work we think we're called, being called to be about. And so what happens is we end up discussing whether we like a musical style or which instruments we use instead of talking about, well, why are we worshiping? Or we slip into focusing only on who's already here instead of thinking about those who haven't yet heard the gospel, who haven't encountered Christ, and who desperately need us to be on our game and not forget the Great Commission. Or we get enmeshed in discussions that are founded in fear instead of a conviction that God blesses and resources what he calls his people to be about. So just know what he's calling you to be about, and then you can just get on and enjoy the ride. So these are, I think, are some of the things that really challenged our church board over the last year as we've wrestled with this whole issue about updating our sanctuary. And this temptation to misplace mission as a priority, well, I think it's pretty normal, actually, for churches. I suspect it's always been normal for churches. So it should never surprise us. And today, as you know, we are thinking about giving. And I want to say up front what I hope is obvious, that in the church, mission is more important than money. And there are no qualifiers here. I'm not going to follow up with a statement which says, but. Mission is simply more important than money. Money is important. It's definitely important. And it, as is important how we give our time and how we use our gifts and our talents here in the church. But money is important in that it's useful in making mission happen. But it's never more important than the mission, because mission is everything. The church consultant, Kenan Callahan, thought about this. And he's offered a couple of statements that are paradoxical and completely true. His first assertion is that congregations never have enough money. And his second assertion is that congregations have all the money they need for God's mission. A congregation that is faithfully hearing and responding to God's call for mission never has enough money, because they always give away more than they have. They are, in the eyes of the world, idiotically generous. They are always living on the edge, because they know that, and we talked about this last week, they know that they are completely dependent upon Christ. And if you follow the direction he's leading, you will have enough to do what he accomplished, once accomplished. Now, declining congregations, on the other hand, don't have enough money either, but that's because they've usually misplaced their mission, and people tend to be reluctant to give to a church simply to make a budget. Because budgets are not a substitute for mission. Mission is what people love to contribute to. They're less crazy about budgets. The three M's, and those are money, membership, and maintenance. Money, membership, and maintenance. The three M's are typically the driving concerns of declining churches. But they are never a substitute for mission. On the other hand, a congregation that has a clear mission, one they're committed to, will usually have what they need. Though it'll often seem like it's just not quite enough. And so I trust you'll remember last week's report from the treasurer. This is something that usually spurs the group to greater commitment to the mission. We're just going to try a little harder next year. So mission always comes first. And money will follow mission. Now, I say all this because I want to talk about giving and money, but I know that to talk about money without talking about mission in the church is pointless and doomed to failure. It should be. And those of you who attend here regularly will know that we're pretty much a broken record when it comes to thinking about mission. There at the top of our bulletins, week after week, is the assertion that our mission is to follow Jesus Christ. And week in and week out, we're reflecting on what that means for us, what following Jesus looks like in the context of being members of St. Stephen's United Church. But this week, I'd like us to think together a little about why we do give money and why we don't often talk about it. And there's at least a couple of reasons we don't talk about it. Well, actually, there's more, but one particular reason, and might as well start with this one. There's a reluctance amongst people like me to talk about it because it might look like we're singing for our supper. I mean, my salary comes from what you give. So we're kind of nervous about talking about it. Or we are afraid that if we do talk about it, some members of the congregation will feel uncomfortable and they won't like us. And people like me really want everybody to like us. I think that's why churches invite stewardship experts to come in and speak just about this thing. It takes people like me away, and we can say, oh, gee, I had nothing to do with that. It's funny, this discomfort about talking about matters financial, it's really curious, especially in a denomination that's long thought of itself as liberal and progressive, and yet we become strangely Victorian about things to do with our wallets. Have you ever noticed that? You know, we can talk about sex and politics and social change. We're always ready to do that. But money, you know, there are some things that really we really do need to keep private. But if we are to allow the Bible to have any authority in our lives, it means that we need to go there now and then. And that's especially so for those whose mission is to follow Jesus, because he talks about our relationship to our possessions and to money a lot. And it's certainly my sense that our call to mission is not decreasing, it is only increasing. And being that money is one of the ways that we'll be resourcing that mission, well, let's talk. Now, I have no idea whether this is a factual story or not, or whether it was created by some wily preacher somewhere. I like the story, though, so I'm going to share it with you. I think there might be a grain of truth to this. But this is a story about the Gauls. Now, you remember the Gauls? They were the people who were living in what's now France and Belgium. Okay? They were ancient Celts. And like most of Europe and the Middle East, they lived rather uneasily under the control of Rome for a good period of time. And when Rome began to start to become Christianized, the Christian missionaries went off into Gaul, and many of the Gauls became Christian. And of course, the prime rite of initiation into the Christian faith is baptism. We talked about that last week. And so many were baptized. The story goes, though, that some converted warriors, when they were being dunked, would hold their arm out of the air, their dominant arm. It wouldn't go into the water. And what would happen then is when the next battle came on, the warrior would then pick up a weapon announcing, "This arm is not baptized." And then they could plunge off into war with all sorts of unholy enthusiasm. I like that story. It's like the story about Constantine's baptism at his death. You know that? He was not baptized until just before he died. And the reason that then he could do whatever sinful things he wanted until the moment before he died. And then he could die in a state of grace. Oh, we are cunning. God would never have thought of those things. I know. Maybe it's just a popular myth, but there is something compelling about this image of someone trying to keep some part of their body, some element of their life, free from the influence of their faith. And so once again, we're dealing with the problem of trying to compartmentalize our lives. But our relationship to money is very much a part of our lives. And Jesus addressed that relationship over and over and over again. So all of us have to make decisions about how we're going to deal with money. It's not that we can't. We have to. And our faith actually has something to offer in our decision making. A favorite preacher of mine, John Ortberg, directed me to a metaphor used to describe our relationship with money. And typically Ortberg, who is also a trained psychologist, pointed me towards a couple of British psychologists. Their names are Stephen Lee and Paul Webley. And you can find a link to this article they've written. It's on our church Facebook site. I put it up there yesterday if you want more information. But in a nutshell, what Lee and Webley say is that money can serve as both a tool in our lives and as a drug in our lives. So money can function like a tool when we use it to achieve an end. Say, you know, to get 3 square meals a day, you know, put our kids through school, all that kind of thing. So if it's a tool, the question does come up, though, is why do people who have more money than they could use to achieve those ends so often want more money? Interesting, eh? Sometimes they will want money to the point of that they're prepared to damage their families and their friendships just to get more money. Well, money can function as a tool, and it can act like a drug in that it gives us a sense of well-being. It can seemingly soothe us like a drink or a pill can. And just like a drink or a pill, it provides only temporary relief. You need to get more. So Ortberg approaches this issue, though, using classical biblical terms. He asks whether money is being a servant or whether money is being an idol. Is money functioning as a tool or is it functioning as a drug? Is it serving us or has it become like a god in our lives? Now to deal with this very real concern, God has given us a way of dealing with what's really an old, old problem. And the way to get this in check is to embrace a form of disciplined generosity. If you carefully read through the Old Testament, you'll see how the word tithe gets used about a dozen times or so. And the word tithe means a tenth of something, one tenth. And there's all sorts of interesting discussion on giving 10% and whether that means 10% of net or 10% of gross, or does that include a housing allowance, you know, that kind of thing. Oh, we get very cunning about this stuff. And I found that those discussions usually end up taking us to really bizarre places. And so I find that the best approach to talk, way to talk about this is to just simply talk about percentage giving. And what number that percentage is up to you. It could be 10% or 15% or whatever. You figure out the percent. The point of this is to be generous and to be disciplined in that generosity. And I liken it a bit like to being in love, to loving someone. If I'm only loving when I feel like it, well, it will soon become obvious to all and everyone I love that I am even more of a jerk than they first thought. You know, that's why in part we in the Christian faith don't get too worked up about the feeling of love as much as we get focused on the practical aspects of love. Because that's all 1 Corinthians about. 1 Corinthians 13 is about not what you feel, it's about how you live. So we try to love, we try to act in loving ways, even when we're not feeling the love, you know? So we practice a disciplined love, and similarly, we practice a disciplined generosity. And the church has tried to learn from that. The church, when it's on, is generous and it is disciplined in that generosity. In ancient Israel, did you know this? They didn't exactly just have one tithe, but they had a number of different tithes. The first tithe you can read about is found in the book of Numbers. And it was referred to as the offering to the Levites. So remember the story. The Hebrew people, they are enslaved in Egypt. They are freed by God. They wander around in the wilderness for 40 years. And they are eventually brought to the promised land. And they come into the promised land. And in ways that disturb us, they conquered the territory. And then the territory was divided up. The 12 tribes of Israel were each given a portion of the territory. All except one. They actually divided it into 11 pieces. The tribe of Levi, who function as the ones who look after worship, they didn't get territory. They got the tithe. So that's the first tithe. There's a second tithe that's found in Deuteronomy, and that was a tenth of what your fields would produce in a year, and that, you know, grain and wine and firstborn of herds and flocks and that kind of thing. And this tithe was used in the worship and celebration that was in the temple in Jerusalem. And what's happening here is that God's trying to connect giving and generosity with joy. Because honestly, compulsion is the lousiest motivator in Christian giving. Giving because I have to? When our giving becomes a form of taxation, we've really lost our direction. Giving is meant to come from the heart. It is meant to come from joy. It is meant as a form of thanksgiving. And it is connected to mission. And that's what's going on in our scripture reading today from 2 Corinthians chapter 9. See, what's happening here is if really been on, I'd have read you chapter 8 as well. It gives more of a context. But we only have so much time. But what Paul's going on about is he's trying to arrange a collection for the poor in the church in Jerusalem. Because times are really tough in Jerusalem and the poor are suffering terribly. They're in dire need of help. And so he was calling on the church all around the Mediterranean to assist as best they could. And in chapters 8 and 9 of 2 Corinthians, he is addressing those church members there in Corinth, and he's trying to motivate them. He's not trying to bully them or shame them or anything, but rather he's trying to get them to see themselves as players in this great drama that God is writing. And he's trying to get them to see themselves as participants in God's mission. And he says, give and enjoy. Because when you participate in this, you just warm God's heart. God loves a cheerful giver. I was recently talking with a clergy friend who lives in another part of the province. And I've realized now that I'm at that point in my career that I get asked to converse with newer ministers, largely to help them avoiding doing the glaring errors that I entered into. Don't do this. This will not end well. And so I've got a number of people I talk to each month, once a month, about the peculiar work we do. And I don't know if they're doing any better, but I am. I'm being reminded of, don't do that. I was talking to one of my friends the other day, and I confessed to them that for me, one of the greatest thrills in my job is getting to see people's lives shift and change as a result of the faith they're growing into. You know, that never gets old for me. It never gets old. And I am regularly blessed because I see it here all the time. And I'm wanting to encourage you to do the same. I'm encouraging you to look around at what we're about here. And you know, if you do that, you will see how lives shift and change because of the mission that we're doing together. I had this happen the other day. Somebody walked in, and a pretty knowledgeable person, a member of the community, not a member of our congregation, and he said, I want to talk to you about how wonderful the seniors' tea is. He said, I talk about it all the time. I tell other churches that they need to do it as well as St. Stephen's do, because the difference it makes in people's lives is enormous. Was that ever cool? And things like that happen because of what you give to this church in your time and in your energy and in your offerings of money. See, your givings to God, they really do make a difference. Some of you also give to other parts of the church on top of that, and that's a good thing too. Something we try to practice in our house as well. So some of you choose to give to organizations, you know, like Compassion, or you give to Young Life, or you give to the Mission and Service Fund, as we heard about this morning. There's a variety of really fine church and parachurch organizations, and the mission is well served in those contributions as well. There are actually more tithes that are talked about in the Old Testament. In Israel, they had something called a poor tithe. It's described at the end of Deuteronomy chapter 14. And it was something that was collected every 3 years so that, and I quote, the aliens, and when they say aliens, they mean like immigrants and people who are foreign. Aliens and the fatherless and the widows who live in your towns may come and eat and be satisfied, and so that the Lord your God may bless you with all the work of your hands. So we're now up to three tithes, right? And a quick computation reveals that probably more than 20% of people's resources were being given back to God. And some of you are saying, well, that's really cool, but I can't afford 10%. Fair enough. Fair enough. Try a lower percentage for a while. And then, as you live into that, see if you can raise it 1%. We're not talking big jumps. And if that works, maybe you can try it again. I know this actually works. But as you try that, here's something else we can learn from the disciplined generosity of the people of ancient Israel. And that has to do with the generosity of first fruits. In Exodus chapter 23, we read of God's call to bring the best of the first fruits of your soil to the house of the Lord your God. Farmers would locate their best and their healthiest and their first plants, and they would then thank God for the anticipated harvest by returning them to God. And they would make a really, really big deal out of this. They would parade the first fruits up to the temple. There would be a party atmosphere, be celebratory. It would be a party. The Apostle Paul would later pick up on this in that all-important 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians. I would commend that one to you. It is absolutely brilliant. The 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians. And he writes that, in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have died. He was saying that Jesus is God's first fruit. He is the best that can be imagined. He is the best that God could give to us. And when Jesus stepped out of the tomb, it meant that his whole crop of humanity was about to follow. Now, the problem that I face is the temptation to come at this from a last fruits position. I mean, I know this one well. It works this way. I get paid. I pay my bills. I wait until the end of the month to really make sure that I paid my bills. And then I look to see how much I can afford to give. And this practice of last fruits, well, usually when I engage in that, I usually don't have as much. Interesting, eh? It is sometimes also referred to as the doctrine of leftovers. And that's why we and countless other churches encourage the practice of PAR in our church. That's pre-authorized remittance. And it's a really helpful way of living into first fruit giving as opposed to last fruit giving. And I suspect most of us who use PAR or who alternatively begin the month by writing a check as opposed to ending the month by writing a check, those of us who do one of those two things will tell you that it is enormously satisfying. It really is. It is even slightly celebratory. There's a moment of, it's not quite a parade to the temple, I admit, but it's pretty good. But the people of Israel, they've even practiced another form of disciplined generosity. Remember, these were an agricultural people, and as those of you who've lived on a farm will know, harvest time is the agricultural equivalent to payday. In Leviticus chapter 23, verse 22, we read, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very edges of your field, but gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the alien." They leave the produce on the edges of their field for the poor to take. And that may start you to thinking, yes, the book of Ruth. Remember, that's how she connected with Boaz partway through. And others of you may have been thinking about the sixth chapter of Luke. Remember, that's the account where the disciples are going through some grain fields on the Sabbath, and they pick some grain and they eat them. And they got into trouble, right? And why did they get into trouble? They got in trouble for working on the Sabbath. The picking of the grain was considered work. They were not in trouble for stealing. By no means. They were simply doing what poor people did to feed themselves. The disciples were poor. They became poor. And that's how the poorest of the poor live, from day to day. And when Jesus taught the disciples how to pray, he included this petition. This will be familiar to you. "Give us this day our daily bread." When Jesus said that, I think he was identifying with the poorest of the poor. Folk who live day to day. Who ultimately realize that they are dependent on God. There is no doubt in my mind that the earliest church placed considerable priority on the plight of the poorest people. In fact, if you look in the previous chapter of 2 Corinthians, in chapter 8, Paul was reminding the Corinthian church about that when he wrote, For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. I think he was reminding the Corinthian church and reminding our church to honor and care for the poor. That's why that M&S minute was so good today. I am convinced that there is no greater mission, no better mission for a church than this. And so once again, we mix mission and money, money and mission. Those two things are always brought together. And if you want to do one, you got to do the other. But we try to do this in disciplined generosity, because that's how Jesus' people live. So I'm going to invite you now to pray. And the prayer I'm going to offer was first offered some 500 years ago by St. Ignatius of Loyola, who you might remember was the founder of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits. So let's pray. Lord, teach me to be generous. Teach me to serve you as you deserve, to give and not count the cost, to fight and not heed the wounds, to toil and not seek the rest, to labor and not to ask for reward, save that of knowing that I do your will. O Lord, teach me to be generous. Amen.